1 Corinthians chapter 1, I'll read verse 26 through the end of the chapter. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many were influential, not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord.
I appreciate the reading that James just did for us, and we will get to that passage. But be turning in your Bibles to Judges chapter 7, and in keeping with the verse there, not many wise, not many noble, not many mighty, depending on your translation. Let's take a look at an example you might have gathered we would be looking at from the title, Dog Lappers. If you're visiting with us this morning, and I know we do have several visitors in the crowd, we're glad you're here. We want to welcome you to the church that meets here from time to time. Hope you'll want to come back and be with us. And I hope after hearing a lesson about dog lappers, you'll still want to come back and be with us. We would, I'll join in with the announcement. Please do, if you can, fill out a visitor's card for us. We'd like to have a record of you being here. But welcome to the church that meets here at East Orange. Extraordinary results from ordinary people. God in the Bible has made a habit, or whatever you want to call that, but a way of presenting to us the fact that ordinary people can in fact bring extraordinary results. And as we're thinking in terms of that, I want us to look indeed at the story of Gideon and the 300 men that are talked about in Judges chapter 7. We might think, and it is another typical story, if you're reading in the Bible, you're not surprised by Judges 7, especially in the book of Judges. You're not surprised when you come to Judges 7 and there is yet another enemy to be dealt with, yet another victory to be won. And to be sure, the book of Judges is about that. In this particular case, God has sent, as the cycle is in Judges. The people have been unfaithful, and so God has sent the Midianites against them. And they need a deliverer, as a champion, as is commonly the case. But this particular time, God doesn't choose your typical champion. He doesn't choose, for example, a Samson that we commonly think of as the strong warrior and so forth, but he chooses Gideon. And I'm not going to take time this morning to go through Judges 6. You might want to go home and read that. But if you do, you'll find that Gideon is less than your Samson-type figure. He's just not that stellar individual we're used to seeing. And by the time you come to Judges 7, and you have the problem with the Midianites, you realize that God is going to really takes some surprising turns in this story as he brings about deliverance or salvation for his people. In fact, if you'll read with me verses 1 through 7, we'll read this and then we'll make some points from it. It says, then Zerubbabel, who is Gideon, and we know him better as, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said unto Gideon, verse 2, the people that are with thee are too many for me. Notice this. The people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Now therefore go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And there returned of the people 22,000, and there remained 10,000. And the Lord then said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I'll try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I shall say to thee, this shall go with me, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I shall say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. And so he brought down the people unto the water. And this is where it takes a really surprising turn. He brought down the people unto the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, everyone that lappeth of the water with his tongue, like a dog laps, him shalt thou set by himself. Likewise, everyone that bows down upon his knee to drink. And the number of them that lapped, like a dog, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. And the Lord then said unto Gideon, by the 300 men that lapped will I save you, and deliver the Midianites into thine hand, and let all the other people go every man into his place. Now you read the story, and it goes on to show how God does effectively, decidedly, bring victory to the Israelites by Gideon, again, a less than stellar champion, if you read his character in chapter 6, and 300 men that basically qualified for this heroic venture by lapping water like a dog. Now, it's an interesting story. And you, at first glance, you might look at it and say, why does God do this? And I believe there's some reasons why God does this, and I want us to explore it. I want us to see exactly what this text says. But 300 men, together with Gideon, are going to bring victory with, again, those surprising turns. I want to suggest to you that God doesn't save his people. Whether we're talking about the fight against the Midianites, or we're talking about the fight against sin today, God doesn't save his people by conventional means. In fact, if you look at this story, he doesn't save them by what we might call sound military tactics. I mean, you start off with, you know, perhaps you start off here with 32,000 of maybe the best, of the people who qualify to be soldiers, at least the way most people would look at it. You take the men out to battle, and they're, you know, you're not taking the old and the weak and the women and all of that kind of, but you're taking men out to battle here. Sound military tactics, and as you go on to read here, we're talking about thousands of Midianites we've got to fight against. So sound military tactics would tell you amass as great an army as you can amass, at least in this day and time. If you're going to go out and fight with swords and spears and bows and so forth, you need manpower. It's not sound military tactics to begin to divide your people, and especially would you not go to a group of soldiers before the battle and say, hey, if anybody's scared, go home. I have uncles and, you know, have a number of relatives that fought in various wars, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, etc., that I'm, you know, that I was well aware of and talked to. They'll tell you the same thing. Everybody is scared. I mean, it, to some degree, everybody is scared. So you wouldn't go to them and say, if you're scared, go home. You know, because if I were out there and I were about to have to march into the face of an enemy with a sword or a spear, and somebody asked me, are you afraid? I would say, yeah. And if you, you know, and would you like to go home? Yeah, I would, you know. So, I mean, it's just not sound military tactics. Now, on the other hand, God doesn't save them by the purely miraculous. He could. And there are times when God demonstrates his power and ability. I think two things immediately come to mind. There are many in the Bible. But I think in terms of, you know, dividing the Red Sea, just watch the power of God. And then that great Egyptian army, Pharaoh tries to come across with the chariots and whoosh, God destroys them. God could have saved them by the purely miraculous, but he doesn't. He just doesn't choose that. You know, Jesus demonstrated his power in John 18 when they came out to arrest him. And the Bible says, he said, you know, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus, you know. And he said, I am. And they all just fell back to the ground. That's the power of God. But he doesn't do it by the purely miraculous. What he does in this passage is he uses 300 dog lappers. And that's what I'm calling people, because the text literally does say that they bring water to their mouth and they don't just drink it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever scooped water, if you've ever been in a situation where you scooped water in your hands. I'm sure we all have. And you put it up and you drink, you make a little cup and drink. They don't do that. But if you've ever watched a dog drink, you know, he gets his tongue in it, and he scoops water up, you know. That's what these dudes do. I mean, out of thousands of people, you get three. I don't know why they do that. But 300 people lap like a dog. And God says, that's the ones. I'll take those. Now, if you were Gideon, you're not full of confidence and bravery to begin with. And you've got to be thinking, I'm going out to meet the Midianites with 300 dog lappers? Now, it's not surprising that God would do that. Because when you think about the stories in the Bible, think about it for a moment. God uses very ordinary people. He used a shepherd boy to defeat a giant. People were amazed by that. He wasn't the tallest guy, the biggest guy, the strongest guy. Saul might have been that. But God used a shepherd boy. Young man. At most he's, 15, 18 years old, somewhere in that range. With a sling. And he goes out and defeats a giant. And God used a peasant girl. Common. Ordinary. As far as the world would have seen her. Nothing special in Mary. Nothing that makes her stand out. I mean, we're not talking about a Cleopatra here. Or the Queen of Sheba. We're not talking about what the world renowns as a Helen of Troy, the face that launches a thousand ships. She just is presented to us as an ordinary girl. She's special. Don't misunderstand. But to the world, she's just a peasant girl. Yet she gives birth to and raises a Savior. It's not surprising when you think about the fact that God really used four fishermen, a Pharisee, Paul, a tax collector, a zealot, a handful of mostly uneducated, common laborers is really what they were. They were disposed to boasting, doubting, and fear, wanting to be first, got to be number one, you know. Even prejudice. You think about Peter and some of the things he did. And yet God used them to spread Christianity all over the world and to initiate a religion that has not just lasted, but triumphed. For 2,000 years. And if the Word of God means anything, it will to the end of time. God has used ordinary people to produce or accomplish really extraordinary results. So it's not surprising when I look in the Bible in Judges 7 and I find a story like this. Now, let's examine it a little bit closer. Let's look at Judges 7:2 again. When the Lord said to Gideon, the people are too many. Here were the thousands, the 32,000 or whatever it is out there. They're too many. It's too many. And you notice why God says that. It's too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands. Lest Israel should vaunt themselves, the King James says. The idea has to do with pride and boasting. Lest they would boast and say, look what we did. And you know, people are given to that. Sometimes you have people and they think, and especially if they have a victory, they think they do it all. Sometimes life is like that. People are like that in life. And when they accomplish something or they do something, they begin to look at themselves, they kind of focus inwardly, not outwardly at God, but they focus inwardly and they say, look what I did. And that's the way they feel about it. And God said, if I send these 30,000 out, if I send them out there and they have a victory by conventional means, you know, they stand toe-to-toe and they fight and they have a victory, what they'll do is boast. What they'll feel like is they did it all. And I'm not going to use people who think they do it all and they can do it all. I'm not going to use those boasting, prideful people to save you. So separate. I want to diminish the number. And you know, when you look in the Bible, there are a number of passages. I won't touch on every one of them, but I want to focus on a couple anyway. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 17, where God warned the people. Now, in this particular passage, if you're open to it, you'll notice the Israelites are going into Canaan. Moses is warning them before they ever go in. You're going to go in there and you're going to find cities you didn't build and vineyards you didn't plant and wells you didn't dig. You're going to go in there and you're going to have victory. In fact, we come to understand in the book of Joshua, they defeat about 31 cities, some of them major, fortified cities, like and beginning with Jericho. And when they do that and they have that kind of victory, God warns them beforehand. But be careful, lest when you go in there and you have that victory and you find all of that wealth, be careful lest you begin to say you've gotten that wealth, verse 17, by your own hands, your own might alone. You be careful. I forewarn you. In Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 13, in fact, beginning about verse 5 there, God begins to warn the people or to prophesy to the people. I'm going to use the Assyrians. And he says in verse 5, the Assyrian is, quote unquote, the rod in mine hand. And God uses Assyrian, uses the king of Assyria to come against the Israelites. Sargon, I believe, is the king's name. To come against the Israelites and defeat them. And then God begins to prophesy in the next several verses. Now, Jerusalem, I'm going to send the Assyrians against you. I'm going to send the Babylonians against you. But I'm going to send the Assyrians against you, and basically it would be Sennacherib. But they're not going to achieve this. They're going to fail. And the reason they're going to fail is for the very reason in Proverbs 16 and verse 18, when God says, often misquoted of course, pride goes before a fall, but actually, pride goes before destruction. And a haughty spirit, vaunting oneself, boasting, goes before a fall. And that's exactly what was Sennacherib's problem. And because of that, it was his undoing. And God prophesies that beforehand. He'll begin to say, I did it. I did it. I did it. When in fact he didn't do it, I will choose for him to have victory over my people. And I will choose if he doesn't. But people are disposed to do that. If they have a victory, they did it. If they have a defeat, hey God, where were you? You know, that's just the way people are. I want you to turn in the New Testament, if you will, to the books of Corinthians, and let's start in that passage James read for us. There are several things that are said here, some things that Paul says that are very interesting and things we need to take to heart. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, let's go back and begin in verse 26. We'll touch upon two or three things in the passage. First of all, Paul talks about our calling. Notice that in verse 26. He has been speaking of wisdom and foolishness, and how the world views all of that. But in verse 26, notice Paul says, you see your calling. And there are not a lot of wise people. I mean, if you've been a member of the church for a long time, and like I told you a couple of weeks ago, I have for 34 years now. If you've been a member of the church, you begin to look around you and you realize that the so-called wisest or most brilliant people the world has to offer generally are not members of the church. And there's some exceptions, but generally. And the richest of people, the most aristocratic, the most noble, the royalty, etc., they're just not members of the church. And the Bible begins to explain to us that generally speaking, it's not many of these that come to God. They might come, if they did, full of boasting, full of pride, at their achievements in life, at who they are, at what they've done, etc. And that really is not the mindset, it's not the attitude of people who will submit to God as God really demands. And so you look at this passage and notice how God has said in verse 27, he's chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. It's an interesting term there. It has to do with conviction. It has to do with confusion. It even has to do with contradiction. But the point is, God will strip away all of your preconceived notions through the gospel. God will strip away everything that anyone who was overly confident ever thought about himself or ever felt about herself. And what God will do is confound you, in fact, through what are considered the foolish things by the world. I've listened to very brilliant, educated people rail against God's choice, supposedly, God's choice, as they would put it, for salvation. To sacrifice his own son, to put him on a cross, to have the majority of the world reject him. And they rail at that. They laugh at that. And they speak of how they would have done it were they God. And they come away looking like fools. It's The questions that people posed that they couldn't possibly have answers for, and yet they charge God with being insufficient. God is telling us here in this passage, He chooses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and the very weak things, as we might see it, to confound the things that are strong and mighty. You notice as this passage goes on, look at verse 28, the base things. I chose this passage because it reflects Judges 7. I don't know how much more base you can get than people who lap water like a dog. I mean, that's just very base. And those are the base kinds of things that human beings do. It's not the thing that lifts man above the animals. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there are a lot of things you can choose in the Bible and you can show how man is the highest of God's creation, but Judges 7 ain't one of those passages. Okay? They lap like a dog. But if you listen to this, the base things of the world and the things which are despised has God chosen. Yes, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing those things that are. As you can meditate on that passage all day long, but you see how God takes an army, a massive army in Judges 7, and reduces it to nothing in a matter of moments. And He does it through 300 people who lap water like a dog. When you listen to the close of this passage in 1 Corinthians 1, as He tells us in verse 29, that no flesh should glory in His presence. When we realize the ability of God, when we realize how God can unfold a plan, when we might not understand, had I been back there in that army and I knew that I had been chosen for the single reason that I drank funny, you know, I drank my water funny, you get chosen, man, you know. Well, what does that mean? How does that make me able to stand up to an army with overwhelming odds now that you've taken all the thousands and sent them home? When I think in terms of how God unfolds a plan, and if I were back there in that time, I would have looked at that. I might have said, well, you know, what's going on here? Why are you doing this? Bring those thousands of people back. And yet God's plan unfolds, and you think after it's over, after that battle was over in the next day, what those people must have been feeling. I mean, they look at that and they say, man, what God does. And have you ever felt that way? That no man should glory in the presence of God. No, we glory from God. We glory through God. And we boast only, notice verse 31, in the Lord. Look with me at 2 Corinthians. I don't spend near as much time on this passage, but look at 2 Corinthians 4. It's very similar. It talks about how so many people are blinded by Satan. But it also talks about how God chooses us, notice verse 7, in earthen vessels. Why are we in human bodies? Why do we have human bodies to begin with? Our soul is eternal. It's the far more glorious part of us. Our mind, you know, our spirit, etc. But if there's one thing that gets old and decrepit and falls apart and, you know, all the things that go on with the human body, and you get reminded of that. The older you get, the sicker you get, and so forth and so on, you realize how unattractive and really how less than glorious your human body is. Now, I realize you can talk about the function of the eye and the brain and all of that kind of thing, and you can really, you know, be amazed. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the fact that God has chosen for our eternal soul to be housed in a human body that is given to decay. But yet, listen to what He says here. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. Why? Well, that the excellency of the power, notice, may be of God and not of us. And then He begins to say in passages like verses 8 and following, He begins to talk about all the trouble and so forth that comes to the human body. Now go back to verse 5 here. That's why we preach not ourselves, but we preach Christ Jesus the Lord and ourselves your servants for Jesus' sake. Now notice verse 6 in particular. For God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Do you see what He's saying there? If you want to talk about a human being, you talk about a dog lapper. If you want to talk about a human body, you talk about a dog lapper. If you want to talk about a victor in God, a victor in Jesus Christ, you don't talk about us. You talk about Jesus. You talk about God. Because if we're glorious, if we're victorious, if there's anything that at the end of this life shines throughout all of eternity, it will be one thing and one thing only. And it surely isn't that I lap water like a dog, or all the host of other things I do. It is that I had Jesus Christ in my heart and in my life. And at the end of time, the thing that is going to be glorious for God's people, the one common thing that will be glorious for them, is that they had Jesus in their lives. And it's the one lasting thing. Now, go back to Judges 7, and let's notice a couple of other things. In Judges 7 and verse 3, what he said was, the people are still too many. Notice he has separated some, but they're still too many. And then he began to talk about the cowardly people. And you'll notice there's a couple of phrases here that's used, but I want to note something about cowards to begin with. I've noticed in my life, and I want you to understand something before I say this. I've told you before, and I'll tell anybody, for the first 11 years, a little over 11 years, I was this world's biggest coward. I didn't know anybody that was more cowardly than I was, and much to the shame and chagrin of my father, who was not a coward, I promise you. But I was. I was just scared. I mean, the whole idea of two people fighting, of one, you know, of somebody else standing there and hitting you, I didn't like to be hit. It hurt. And I would think about that. And then when you start talking about a fight, and if you ever witness one, and you see one boy hit the other one in the nose or the mouth, and blood starts coming out, it made me sick to my stomach. So anytime there was any threat of any kind of fight or whatsoever, I ran. And I got a reputation for that. I mean, you know, bullies picked on me, boys chased me, etc., etc. Now, without going any further in that, I want you to understand something. I know what it means to be a coward. I understand how it feels. I know what it means to do exactly what this passage in verse 3 says. Notice what God said. Whosoever is fearful and afraid. If you have other translations, it will say something like fearful and trembling. You'll notice it says something like shaking. That's literally what cowards do. I mean, the thought of being beat up, the thought of being of someone else doing something physically to them makes them literally shake, and it's uncontrollable. I know what that feels like. And so what God says, if they're like that, not just that they have honest fear because they're not stupid, you know? I mean, we fear death and we fear certain things. It doesn't stop us from doing what we have to do. God isn't talking about that. The language lets you know that he's talking about people who are cowards. They're just shaking from their fear. They're unable to do. They're unable to perform. And God said, those that would depart early. Notice that. Let him return and depart early. If you're given to that, then run away. If that's what you do, then run. I know what that feels like. I know exactly what that means to be one of those people. And God separated those people. Why? Well, for one thing, cowards tend to boast to cover it up. It's been my experience in life that most bullies are inherently cowards. It got to a point where I got tired of that. And finally one day, in the middle of the day at school, got in trouble for this, mind you, but in the middle of the day at school, I got tired of being bullied. And I popped a guy. And he shriveled up like a coward. And this was a guy who had been bullying me for going on 2 solid years. Now, I learned something about bullies. Most of them boast because they're cowards. And what happens is, if you take a coward and you put him in a real situation, all of his boasting aside, he'll turn to cowardice and he'll tend to overthrow the courage of others. Because after all, if the guy that's the most boastful and seems to be the strongest, if he starts shaking out of fear, where does that leave the rest of us? And so God said, I don't want those. I can't use them. Send them home. And that's why God separated them. They think they can't do anything. That's the way they feel. That's the way they act. They boast, but all their boasting aside deep down inside, they really feel like they can't. And God has never used people like that. He didn't use them when they started to enter Canaan. Remember, He sent the spies out. They came back cowardly and trembling. Fine, wander around for 40 years. I've had it with you. But God uses those who are not full of fear. Deuteronomy 20 really shows us this. You look at Deuteronomy 20, and I won't turn there to that passage, but it describes that mindset. And if you're looking at that passage, you can see it. The mindset of people who believe they can. They might have honest fear. They believe they can accomplish through God's help. They can accomplish what God needs them to accomplish. Revelation 21 and verse 8, though, teaches us God will have nothing to do with the coward. The coward is the first in the list among murderers and idolaters, etc., who will be in hell. But the fearful, the King James says, the cowardly and the faithless, they go to hell. Finally, in this passage in Judges 5, and we've already talked about this all through the lesson, God finally says there's too many. So He separated everybody that lapped the water with His tongue like a dog. There were 300 of them out of thousands. God accepts victory through the most ordinary of people. The lowliest. I'll call them idiosyncratic. That's a euphemistic way of saying they're just a little nutty, a little quirky. They do things that are odd. Most members of the church I ever knew, including me, number one, we're a little quirky. We're a little odd. We're a little different. Probably wouldn't be here if we weren't. But God uses people, even if they lap like a dog. But you'll notice in this passage what you don't see out of them. You don't see boasting. They don't vaunt themselves. They have no preconceived notions that they are the best, and they don't talk like they are. And you don't see the fear. And I'm not talking about honest fear. I'm talking about the idea of cowardice. You don't see cowardice here. You don't see them trip. When they're told, remember what we were talking about earlier? If you were selected and it's finally pared down to 300 people, what might you say? They don't. You don't see them objecting to Gideon and saying, forget this, let's go home. No, they go ahead and do exactly what they're commanded to do. And they have a great victory because of it. We see in sometimes the oddest of people, we see God saving the world. People that otherwise might be considered, and I know He won't mind me saying this, I could tell you a story, I don't have time today, but one of my best friends I've ever had lives down in Exton, Pennsylvania. He's been here and preached a gospel meeting before. Jeff Smeltzer, if you would have looked at him in high school, and I did, he was the kind of guy that fit this description. I don't mean he lapped like a dog, but there are things about Jeff that they didn't stand out as the greatest athlete or the greatest this or the greatest that, but he was. I want you to understand that. No matter how nerdy he might have seemed to me at one time and all of that kind of thing, we've laughed about this many times. He was. Because deep down in his heart, he had a confidence. It wasn't boasting, but he had a confidence that if you just simply do what God tells you to do, you can approach that, and if you'd seen me, you'd know exactly why it would be that kind of thing. You can approach that guy, and you can offer him the gospel. There's no telling what he might do. I mean, he might curse you out, and I did that a lot. He might hit you, and I did that a lot. He might be really vile and angry towards you. I did that a lot. Jeff saw that kind of thing, but he still came to me with the gospel because he had a confidence from God, and God used that. And that's what I'm talking about here. Even the people that to the world might seem the lowliest or the odd, the quirky, whatever, God uses their confidence, not in themselves, but in Him to save the world. 1 Timothy 4 teaches us to look at ourselves and see beyond what the world sees. And if we do that, we can save ourselves and people in the world. I might not see myself as a great warrior, as a king, a royalty. I might not see myself as some great leader or teacher. I might not see myself as a person with the ability to convert people to Christ. It just might not be something I see myself doing with the gospel. And I might not even see myself as good enough. I mean, I might look at myself and say, I shouldn't be counted among the faithful. I'm just not good enough. But I see myself as a dog lapper. That's the truth. For all my faults, you know, I can fit that description. And if that's what it takes to qualify for God to use me, then count me in.